today's shiur is not going to be a shiur in Parashat HaShavuah in the normal sense. Let's say that every so often I have to surprise you. Let us say that therefore, otherwise, that the shiur is going to be a shiur on Kol HaTorah Kula. That was quite a grandiose statement that I just made. What I really would like to do today is a shiur in halacha. And you will, of course, see.
So here is another problem. If, according to Torah, Arabs are allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael, and they're allowed to have the rights of all citizens, so how can you say, therefore, that is in opposition to our ability to conquer? We can't own the land because of that. If it would mean that we can't own the land because of that, there were so many times during the period of Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni that there were many non-Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. So what did that mean? We didn't own the land. We didn't own Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yoshua and Ezra and Nehemiah. And then listen to another sentence. Back again, a quote from Rav Avadya. Ubefrat yesh letzayin, and most specifically we have to point out, shebizman ha'acharon, lately, hadrachim biYehuda v'shomron v'aza hein b'cheskat sakana. The roads of Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza are dangerous. We only have military control over those roads. Without any possibility of crossing them securely. We certainly can't settle or live there. Is the assessment of the situation a correct or a real one? Does this express the reality? And what about 150,000 people who are living there? This was written about 5 years ago. There aren't tens of thousands of people that certainly then and today move across the Kvishim of Yehuda, Shomron, to Aza. The only time that those roads are becoming dangerous are right now when Tzahal is beginning to move out and give it over to the Arabs. Now you hardly see a presence of the Israeli army. But what is he saying? That you can't travel the roads of Yehuda, Shomron, Aza? You can't even settle there. So he says, "Bevadai shezeino bechlal mitzvat hakibush." That certainly is not conquest. It staggers the imagination. But more than that, what happens if the roads of Eretz Yisrael are such that it's dangerous to cross those roads? Because of an enemy. We can't travel the roads. Does that mean that our conquest of Eretz Yisrael is nullified by it? Can't be. You know why it can't be? Devora, in Shidat Devora, in Sefer Shoftim, she writes the following. Bimei Shamgar ben Anat, in the days of the Shofet, the judge, Shamgar ben Anat, Chodlu Orochot, people stopped traveling the roads. The Holchei Netivot, and people that went on the big highways, Yelchu Orochot Akalkalot, went on crooked roads. Chodlu Prazon b'Yisrael, Jews no longer lived in the open cities, but they had to live in fortified cities. Chodlu Prazon b'Yisrael, Chodel. So Dvora in her Shira is describing a period of time at which it's dangerous to move across the roads of Eretz Yisrael. So now, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, that would mean that we are not living in a land sort of that's ours, like Odom Ha'oseh B'Tok Shelo. So therefore, we no longer own the land. If there's no kibush, if there is no conquest, or if the conquest is nullified, then the land isn't ours. So you know what should have happened? Anytime there was a situation of that sort, there should no longer have been the obligation for Truma, Maisa, Shmita, Yovel. We never heard of any such thing in Halacha. Like on again Shmita, off again Shmita, on again Yovel, off again Yovel. Okay, fellas, this year the Badatz notifies everybody, since you can't travel the roads of Eretz Yisrael, you don't have to take Truma and Maisa. There is no such halach. simply, I'm saying even if the roads would be impassable and impassable, it would still not affect the conquest itself. One final halacha. I mean, there's a great deal more to be said. One final halacha. And then a few remarks that, I don't know, maybe they... We can always erase the last part of the tape. There is a halacha in Hilchot Shabbat, Simin Shin Chof Tet in Shulchan Aruch. Goyim that besiege a Jewish city. It's on Shabbos. The question is, can you be Mechal Shabbos or not be Mechal Shabbos? Goyim that come to wage war against the cities of Israel. If they come to take money, in Bo'u Aliskei Mamon, if they come for money, Ein Mechal L'maleim Et HaShabbat, you're not permitted to be Mechal Shabbos. Bo'u Aliskei Nefoshes, if they come to kill, Afilu Stam, and even if they have not made their intentions clear, whether it is to steal or to kill, then it's a sofek pikuach nefesh. Lives may be in danger. So the halacha is yotzim aleihem beklei zayin, you go out with them against them with weapons, umechalim aleihem at haShabbat, and you desecrate the Shabbos. Ubeir hasmucha l'sfar, the last halacha is a city that's near the border. Afilu lo bo el al iske teven v'kash, if they're only coming to take hay and straw, mechalim aleihem et haShabbat, you go to be mechal Shabbos. A border city has a completely different halacha than any other place. A border city, even if the goyim are coming only to steal teven v'kash, straw and hay, you're mechal Shabbos. Says Rashi, it all comes from a Gemara in Masechta Erevin. Says Rashi, why? Because if a border city falls to the hands of the Goyim, it opens up the rest of Eretz Yisrael for conquest. The mighty, strong ones of Klal Yisrael are the ones who are on the border. They are the first line of defense. If a border city falls, all of Klal Yisrael is in danger. And therefore, even if they're only coming to steal, go out and be Mechal Shabbos. Go out and be Mechal Shabbos. But wait a minute. Maybe, as Rav Avadya Yosef says, if we are offered peace, and in the opinion of diplomats, politicians, and military men, there is absolutely no danger whatsoever to Klal Yisrael, then you're permitted to give away land. Do you know what the Shulchan Aruch here is saying? The Shulchan Aruch here is making a fascinating assessment. Let me ask a question on the Shulchan Aruch. Why does the Shulchan Aruch say that if it's a border city, and they're coming only for straw and hay, you go be Mechal Shabbos? First of all, maybe we should ask our military leaders, maybe we should ask them, does this endanger Eretz Yisrael? It doesn't endanger Eretz Yisrael. Maybe we should ask our politicians whether there is a threat or there isn't a threat. Why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch say that we should ask our politicians and we should ask our military leaders? Do you know why? Because our rabbis and the Shulchan Aruch made an assessment. This is their assessment. That you can't trust the guy who comes against the border city. Even if he says clearly he's coming only to take hay and straw, you know what? You have to assume the worst. Your halachic responsibility is to assume he wants to take the city, and then it's going to open up all of Eretz Yisrael for grave danger. That's the assessment of the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch also could have said, let's talk to the generals, let's talk to the politicians, let's talk to the statesmen. Because the Chazal are making an assessment. Making an assessment. And this is their assessment of the situation. This is their assessment. Maybe one final quote, and incidentally about this question of Ir, a city by the border, there is a great deal more to be dealt with, much more to say, but we'll leave that. Let me just read his... Rabbi Avadya Yosef's summation. Hamura mikol ha'amur. what emerges from everything that we've said. She'im yidbarei lema'alam mikol safek, and I'm reading every word in the Hebrew, so you should know that it's a correct translation. Im yidbarei lema'alam mikol safek, if it will become clear beyond any shadow of a doubt, she'yiyeh shalom emet, that there will be real peace beineinu levein shcheineinu haravim, between us and our neighbors, the Arabs, im yurzur lehem hashtachim, if the territories will be returned to them. And on the other hand, kayemet sakanat milchama miyadit, there exists the possibility, the danger of immediate war. Im lo yuzur lehem hashtachim, if the territories will not be returned to them, yesh lahatzil lehem hashtachim, you have to return the territories. Bishum she'en lecha davar ha'omeid b'tnei pikuach nefesh, because there's nothing that stands in the way of pikuach nefesh. So he has said, number one, it has to be clear beyond any doubt, beyond any doubt, that there will be shlom emet, real peace between us and the Arab neighbors. That's on the one hand. And the second part is that it also, on the other hand, if we don't give the territories back, there is the danger of immediate war. You know, because we deal only with immediate problems. This is the way he sees it in Halakha. Only with immediate problems. We don't deal with... it's not our responsibility to deal with problems that may arise in the future. If there is danger of immediately there will be war if we don't return the territories, then for Pikuach Nefesh we're supposed to, in order to save lives, we are supposed to return the territories. I don't believe that any of these conditions have been met. None of these conditions have been met. And I will say quite clearly, in talking with a member of Rabbi Avadia Yosef's family, he said to me, you know, Abba was really taken by surprise that it was an agreement that was made with the PLO. And this morning, like most of you, most probably, we get aggravated every morning when we read the newspaper. So of all things, this morning I read in the paper that Shlomo Ben Izri, who is the Yoshev Rosh Si'at Shas in Knesset, I think he most probably was, he may not have been born, or maybe was a little baby at the time of the Six-Day War, was in kindergarten during the Yom Kippur War. And he is one of our great leaders now, great political leaders. So he said in a speech to the youth of Meretz, said the following, I quote from the paper, "Haheskein im Ashaf, the agreement with the PLO, hushag b'miyuchad, was achieved specially and specifically bizchut trumata shel Shas." Shas were the ones that contributed to the agreement with the PLO. When Rav Avadia Yosef's son tells me a few days before the vote in the Knesset, Abba was very surprised and shocked that the agreement was made with PLO. Right. There is something else that troubles me. I think we once mentioned it in another shiur. We've been talking about a border city. Just two psukim I'm going to deal with, and maybe that will get you will have accomplished something for me that I know. I always tell you that sometimes psychologically you're very good for me. I get out all of my aggressions over here and then I walk out smiling after the shiur. There is a I want to deal with a pasuk in Parshat Chukat. In Parshat Chukat we have the story of Sichon Melech Hamori. And it says, Israel conquered Moshe. Klal Yisrael conquered Sichon Melech Amori. And Jews settled in all the lands of the Amori on the other side of the Jordan. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon. Cheshbon was the city of Sichon. Melech Amori, king of the Amori. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon Melech Amori hi. He waged war against the first king of Moab. He took his whole land from him, Ad Arnon. It seems this city, Cheshbon, is extremely important. I mean, we have to understand why is it important. that there was a city, Cheshbon, that originally belonged to the first king of Moab, and along came Sihon, and he conquered Cheshbon. I tell you, there had been millions of wars over cities since the dawn of civilization. Why is it so terribly important that we should know that there was a fellow Sihon once who conquered a place, Cheshbon? And you have to know that this place, Cheshbon, belonged to the first king of Moab, and Sihon waged war with him. I mean, what does this do for our neshama? I mean, Torah, we assume that every word in Torah is holy. There's something that we're supposed to learn from it. What would we be lacking in our personalities or in our frumkeit if we wouldn't know about Cheshbon and Sihon? And the pasuk goes on. We're not finished yet. The next pasuk, Al King Yomru Hamoshlim, therefore, the balladeers, those who sing in parables, say, Bo'u Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, Tibonev Tikonein Ir Sihon, let it be built and be established, the city of Sihon. My, what a song to the city of Sihon. Ki Eish Yotzami Cheshbon. Pasuk goes on to say, fire came out of Cheshbon, Lehova, a flame, Mi Kiryat Sihon, from this metropolis of Sihon. And you know what? The flame that came from Cheshbon did, Ochla, it consumed Or, Moab, the city of Or in Moab, Bale Bomot Arnon, destroyed the rest of Moab. The Gemara in the Sechta Bava Batra says, Al Kein Yomru HaMoshlim, therefore, the Moshlim, the real meaning of the Pasuk is Moshlim, those who say parables. The Gemara says it also means Moshlim, those who rule. A Moshel is a ruler. What kind of a ruler? The one who rules over his Yetzahara. Al Ken Yomru HaMoshlim, the Moshlim, those who say Mishalim, those who say parables, those who rule over their Yetzahara. Look at Cheshbon and his city of Sihon. Right. It's confusing enough. So I'll tell you something I once heard from my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Ruderman, about 35, 40 years ago. I don't remember everything I heard 35, 40 years ago, but there are certain things that make profound impression. It says the Medrash tells us, Sihon, king of the Amori, attacked Moab. There was on the border of Moab, there was a flea-bitten, one-horse, dusty little outpost called Cheshbon. The king of Moab and his advisors, and of course his Ramat Kal and his local poodle, his Yossi Bailey, they all decided that there's really no point in wasting the effort of the army to make a stand at Cheshbon. So what they did was a tactical and a strategic, brilliant withdrawal from that line, and they set up their defenses beyond the city of Cheshbon. Sihon had time. Sihon came in, he took that little town, which most probably had a jail, a post office, and a bar. He took this little city of Cheshbon, he built, he fortified, he brought in men, material, ammunition. He waited and bided his time as he continued to turn Cheshbon into Festum Sihon, the great fortress of Sihon. And by the time he was finished with the job, there was nothing left to do. Cheshbon became the Kedesh Kvitzav, the springboard to destroy all of Moab. What a horrible mistake it was. And therefore, if so, then the Torah is teaching us a great deal when the Torah tells us, Cheshbon is the city of Sihon, king of the Amori. And he waged war with the first king of Moab, and he took Cheshbon from him. Therefore, the Moshlim, the balladeers say, the story of Cheshbon, Tibonev Tikonein, built and established the city of Sihon, because a fire went out of Cheshbon. A flame from that city of Sihon, and it destroyed the rest of Moab. What a terrible mistake. The Gemara, of course, also says that the same thing is true with regard to the Yetzirah. If you permit the Yetzirah in, then you give him a beachhead. That's all he looks for. He just wants to get one little Averale over there. And once he has you, and he moves in, then he establishes a beachhead. And from that beachhead, the Yetzer Hara is very patient. Very patient. A little few Aveiras today, an Aveira a day will keep the Yetzer Hara right there. And then will come the moment at which the Yetzer Hara will begin to move through the consciousness of the mind of man. But even in the mashal, you have to remember the meaning of the mashal. The grave danger, the destruction that befell Moab because they withdrew from Cheshbon. Now comes the part I believe that most probably should be deleted from this shir. Last week's Sedra. The massacre of Shechem. Shimon and Levi destroy the city of Shechem. In their destruction of the city of Shechem, Yaakov at the end, Yaakov condemns them. I don't think we talked about this pasuk last week. Deal with this pasuk. I'll read the pasuk to you. Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon vel Levi, Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, Achartem oti, you have confused me, lahav isheni biyoshev haaretz, to have made me enemies amongst the people, the inhabitants of the land, baknani ubakrizi, vani metei nispa, and I am only a few people, v'neesfu alayin, they will gather against me, v'hikuni, and they will smite me, v'nishmadeti, and I will be destroyed, ani ubeiti, I and my house. I'm reading from chapter 34, Pasuk 30. Vayomru, the end, the last pasuk in the parasha, is the response of Shimon and Levi. Hachazona, Yases, Ahoseinu, will we permit our sister to be treated as a harlot? For many years, I believe that this statement of Shimon and Levi was one of the great battle cries of all time. Something like, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. Give me liberty or give me death. My only regret is that I have but one life to give for my people. Alright? What else? Or as the general of the American army at the Battle of the Bulge, when the Germans demanded that he surrender, his response went down in history, nuts to you. Or Har Habayit Biadenu, Hachizona Yaset Achotenu. Quite a powerful statement. Let's read it again. There's a problem in what Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi. And I'm going to point out to you what I consider to be most probably one of the most unusual psukim in Tanakh. And I know what you're thinking now. I've said this before about other psukim, and you don't trust me anymore. But listen to me and see if what I'm saying is correct. In this particular respect, it's very unusual. Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon vel Levi. Yaakov said to Shimon vel Levi, Achartem oti, you have confused me. I want to count with you the number of times in this pasuk where the first person singular is used. Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, Achartem oti. Now listen to the way I'm going to read it. Achartem, you confused oti, me. Lahav isheni, to make enemies for me. B'yoshev ha'aretz, taknani uvaprizi. Vani, and I. And Metei Nispar, just a few people. V'ne'esfu alai, and they will gather against me, first person singular. V'hi kuni, and they will smite me. V'nishmade ti, and I will be destroyed. Ani, I, ubeiti, and my family. 8 times. I don't believe there's another pasuk like that in all of Tanakh. What's even more fascinating is, if we were Yaakov and we were talking to Shimon and Levi, what would we have said? Wouldn't it have been so much more effective if Yaakov would have said, you've confused us, You've created enemies for us. We're just a few people. They're going to gather against us and they will smite us and we will be destroyed. Me, us, and all of our families. Look at what you did to all of us. Do you know what Yaakov is telling them? Yaakov is telling them whether the position you took, Shimon Levi, is correct or incorrect, open to debate. Whether what you did was right or wrong, that's not the issue right now. Do you know what the issue is? Who gave you the right to take a step that's going to affect me, even if I'm only one other person? You have freedom to act as long as your action affects only you. Nobody ever gave you the right or the freedom of action to do something that's going to affect me and every other first person singular around. And yet I'm the Tata Eichet. Es kommt nicht, that you should discuss it with me. Earlier Rashi says, Shalom notlu eitzo me'azaken. They didn't ask counsel of the zaken. I believe Rashi saw it in this pasuk. Unusual, 8 times first person singular, when all 8 should have been plural. He's saying, you took action alone. Ich bin eichet mensch. I'm also a human being. I also have feelings. You want to act the bakasha? Act. But who gives you the right to act when your action is going to affect me?
When you hear the pasuk this way, do you know how I hear now the response of Shimon Velevi, Hachazona Yasas Achoseinu? It's no longer the great battle cry. I have a feeling that maybe it was more like a whimper of 2 kids who had been put down beautifully by their father, and they had to have sort of the last word. Is it possible that they said, but Tata, you know, Hachazona, Yasas Achoseinu, you know, can we let that happen? That's what I think it was. I believe the point that's being expressed over here is that there are issues that affect all of Klal Yisrael. And issues that affect all of Klal Yisrael, no one person has the right to decide or to paskin on his own. In all of history, you can check me for this. No posek in all of history has taken a position where he paskins alone on a shaila that affects all of Klal Yisrael profoundly and deeply. Throughout all of Jewish history, a Klal Yisrael shaila was dealt with by a Sanhedrin, and a Sanhedrin paskined according to majority of votes. No one single posek has the right, Klal Yisrael never gave him the right, to paskin a shaila on his own that may very well endanger all of Klal Yisrael. Can't Gedolei Yisrael sit down and discuss it together and arrive at a conclusion from amongst them? But one went ahead and took the law, the halacha, into his own hands. Never happened before in Jewish history. There was never a problem of such gravity that was faced by Klal Yisrael. Achartem, I say, Achartem oti, you've confused me. V'nes fu alai, they will gather chas v'sholem against me, v'nishmadeti aniyu beiti. Who gave you the right to paskin that kind of a shaila alone? And certainly when, as we have demonstrated, there are serious problems with the halachic approach that is taken by Rav Avadi Yosef. Very, very serious problems. It's not that simple at all. On the contrary, I dare say that the weight of halachic opinion would reject his position. And yet, Hefke Gevar, go ahead and take such a position, never done in history. Maybe what triggered all of this, and what I'm going to say now certainly should be erased from the tape. The first Rashi
in Parshat Vayeshev. Didn't I say it? It may even turn out to be a Parshat HaShavua. This week is Parshat Vayeshev. Yeshev Yaakov, Yaakov lived Be'eretz Megurei Aviv. Yaakov finally settled down in Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Megurei Aviv, the land in which his fathers had lived. Says Rashi, Bikesh Yaakov Leishev B'shalva, famous Rashi. Yaakov wanted to live in peace. Kofatz Olav Rugzo Shel Yosef. His peace was shattered by the anger of Yosef. I'm saying we wanted to live in peace. The anger of an Ovadi Yosef has shattered the peace. He doesn't have the right to act on his Psak Halacha. He doesn't have the right to Paskin for Klal Yisrael. He didn't have the right to go talk and learning with Mubarak a few years ago. The Rebbeinu Shlom should forgive me. My intention is, it's eight Tzara liYaakov, it's time of Tzara, and the Gemara says, in a place where there may be a grievous Chil Hashem, Ein Cholkin Kovet L'Rav, don't have to have respect for somebody who may be endangering Klal Yisrael. And I'm talking, I don't have to have respect for his opinion. In terms of Halacha, Gedolei Yisrael disputed Halacha with one another, sometimes in extreme manners. They said things because, as far as Torah is concerned, it has to be a search for truth, for absolute truth. And therefore, in the search for truth, one has to say things precisely as they feel it. Okay, that's it.
And it is now with the permission of the nations of the world, Koma mitzvah Yishu Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of Yishu Eretz Yisrael returns to what it always was, what it had originally been, Sheshkula Keneged Kol Mitzvah of Torah, that is equal to all other mitzvahs of Torah, Limekoma, to its place, and therefore mitzvah Kol Ish L'Sayeya B'Chol Yechol to L'Kanye Mitzvah Zu. And therefore there is an obligation on every person to assist in the fulfillment of this mitzvah. So that means the following. We now have two giants, the Meshech Chochma and the Avnei Nezer, both of whom said, the Avnei Nezer was, of course, it was Ruach HaKodesh when he said, and in the, however, in the event that the nations of the world would give permission, when the Avnei Nezer wrote it about it, he couldn't have dreamt it in his wildest dreams. Who at the turn of the century could even have imagined that the nations of the world would give their approval to something of this? But it happened some 20 or 30 years later. And then following it, the Meshech Chochma said, now the fear of the Shavuot is gone. Rabbi Avraham Shapira of the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkez Harav wrote some 10, 15 years ago a private letter, and somebody brought that letter to me, and it makes a tremendous amount of sense. He says, the moment two giants like the Avnei Nezer and the Meshech Chochma have made a statement, then it becomes necessary, or it should be expected that Gedolei Yisrael who follow them should bend their heads before the awesome Torah personalities that they were. That should have been enough to simply remove the question of the oaths from the halachic agenda. Because he says, even a Godel B'Yisrael has to listen to Das Torah. Even a Godel B'Yisrael, a Posek, has a responsibility to listen to giants. And what we find today is, Rav Avadia Yosef's tshuva is based on the idea that our entire existence over here really is a rejection of the oaths. Yes? About it, but I don't know if I want to speculate. In the Sefer HaKuzri, and I think we once quoted it, in the Kuzri, the king of the Khazars asks the Chaver, the Talmud Chacham, after the Talmud Chacham had told him the importance and the centrality of Eretz Yisrael to the Jew, so he asks him, you know, you sound like a parrot, you're saying things that you don't mean. If Eretz Yisrael is that important, why didn't you go to Eretz Yisrael? This is in chapter, in Ma'amar Sheni, the second section of the Kuzri. I believe it's Perek 20 or 21. where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi makes the most honest and beautiful statement of them all. And he says, Ho vashtami melech kuzar, king of the Khazars, you have shamed and embarrassed me. This was our terrible sin in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, that we didn't go on Aliyah when we should have. And he says, why? Shelo yachlu. And he says, even Gedolei Yisrael didn't leave Bavel. Shelo yachlu lihipare, they could not separate themselves, mi mishkinotehen umein yonehen, from their homes and their businesses. An honest statement. An honest statement. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi made an honest statement. He didn't try to fudge. He didn't try to say, well, it's osir and you shouldn't go, and there's an oath, and it's Tavera, and it's a Zionist state, and Ezra and Nehemiah have brought the dredges of Jewish society to Yerushalayim. That's not the Yerushalayim in which I want to live. He said it honestly, and he said, I can't answer. I have difficulty answering that, your question. Why didn't they simply bow humbly before an Ar Samach? And Armenazah, these were the two big London and the outstanding people of Europe. One in the Lithuanian world and one in the Hasidic world. The Armenazah was the Admor Misachacha. His son was the Shem Mishmuel. I've quoted the Shem Mishmuel last year. I haven't gotten to Shem Mishmuel yet this year. Wait till we get to Shem Mishmuel. Let's just spend another few minutes about the oaths. As far as the question of the oaths are concerned, so there were a number of other opinions with regard to the oaths. One of the other opinions with regard to the oaths is the oath that we should not rebel against the nations of the world, that applies in the nation, in the lands outside of Eretz Yisrael. And incidentally, we kept that faithfully throughout the Golan. Jews were always faithful citizens and good citizens in all of the countries of their exile. The halacha of the shvua of not taking Eretz Yisrael by force, that's a halacha inside Eretz Yisrael. That has nothing to do with the nation of the world, but more than that. What did it say? There's a third oath. The third oath was that the nations of the world should not enslave Jews more than is necessary. Many of the Mefarshim hold that these oaths are inextricably intertwined. In other words, it's two parts of the Heskein Ekronot, the principles upon which Jews are to remain in the exile. If the nations of the world make it possible for them to live there, fine. What happens if the nations of the world go back on their oath? What happens if they don't keep their part of the bargain? They make it impossible for Jews to live in Chutz Lartz. Then we are freed of the oath that we shall not go up to Eretz Yisrael en masse. Certainly after the Shoah, there was no longer any question that the nations of the world had not kept their part of the bargain, and therefore we were free to do as we saw fit. There are other approaches to the oaths. What's important is also to be able to differentiate between that which is argada and that which is halacha, that which is halachic in nature, and that which is part of the ethical teachings of our rabbis. These oaths that we read about over here, obviously, we don't know of any historic moment at which God gathered all Jews together and we raised our right arm. Certainly we know of no time at which he gathered the nations of the world and said, say after me, we shall not enslave the Jews more than is necessary. So what it really means is, this is part of the Agadic section of Talmud, which means in the words of oaths, what our rabbis wanted to say really was good advice for Jews. They knew that Jews were going to be living amongst the nations of the world for 1,000, 2,000 years, and they had to give them good advice. And the truth is, it was sound. It was absolutely sound advice that we should not rebel against the nations of the world, that we should not attempt to invade Eretz Salamas. It's going to fail. It won't work. It may very well be that the third oath was the indication, sort of the escape valve The rabbi said, in their unique terminology, their metaphoric terminology, they're saying, if things get too bad, and it's impossible for Jews to live in the Golan, out. Go to Eretz Yisrael. All right. So therefore I say, one of the underpinnings of the tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef seems very, very difficult to accept. It's built on the idea that we should not even have been here altogether halakhically. Which is not so. Rav Avadya Yosef also should bow before the will of, or the expression of Rav Meir Simcha and the Avnei Ezer. Then he goes on to another thing, where he says that our conquest of Eretz Yisrael is not halakhically viable. Why? Because he says the following. I'm going to read. And he's talking of all things. He's talking about our conquest of the occupied territories, shtachim hakivushim, the occupied territories. And he says the following: it's not valid. It's not legally valid. Why? She'ein lanu melech v'sanhedrin v'udim v'turim. We don't have a king. We don't have a sanhedrin. We don't have the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. And when Jews went out to war, the responsibility was to check. The order had to come from the king. The Sanhedrin had to approve, and the Urim v'Tumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, had to give the final approval. So he says that we don't have Melech, we don't have Sanhedrin, we don't have Urim v'Tumim. So therefore, our conquest of the West Bank was not halachically binding. There's obviously one question that that do you have to ask? So I suggest, therefore, maybe we should not celebrate Hanukkah. How did the Hashmonaim go to war? It was the second Beis Hamikdash. There was no king, there was no Sanhedrin, and there was no Urim v'Tumim. How did the Hashmonaim go to war? Let's assume that there was a Sanhedrin. Let's assume for a moment. I have reason to believe that there may not have been a Sanhedrin operative, but if I'll explain that to you, that's going to take me another hour. But let's even say there was a Sanhedrin. But Sanhedrin alone was not enough. You need Melech, and you need Urim v'Tumim. Melech there certainly wasn't. There was no king. The first ones who were going to become kings were going to be the Hashmonaim themselves. There was no Urim v'Tumim. The Gemara says there were five things that were in the first Beit HaMikdash that were not in the second Beit HaMikdash. And one of the five was the Urim v'Tumim. There was no Aron HaKodesh either. So how did the Hashmonaim go to war? Hello? What does it mean? It means that where there is Urim v'Tumim, there's a mitzvah to ask the Urim v'Tumim. But if there's no Urim v'Tumim, so what do you do? So a Jew can't stand up in self-defense for the rest of history because there's no Urim v'Tumim? Never occurred to anybody to say that. How can anybody say that? So therefore, kill us until the end of history because we don't have an Urim v'Tumim. Urim v'Tumim was never a chovah. It was mitzvah. If you have an Urim v'Tumim and you have an opportunity to get a straight line to God, so you pick up the phone. But that you need Melech, or you need Sanhedrin, or you must have Urim v'Tumim, it's not so, that's not the halacha. And as far as Melech is concerned, the fact is that many of the Mepharshim say, in the absence of Melech, anything that expresses the will of the people has the halacha of Melech. Let me read one other few lines, a section that staggers the imagination. See, he says the following. The Ikar Mitzvah, these are the words of Rav Avadya Yosef, the Ikar Mitzvah according to the Ramban, the Mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael that the Ramban is talking about is Kishah Yerusha V'Yeshiva, the inheriting of the land, and living in the land is Ka'odam Ha'oseh B'Toch Shalom. If I am the owner and I am able to walk around here like a person in his own home. But our conquest today, we can't throw out the Arabs who live in the territories in Yehuda, Shomron, v'Aza. Listen, you have to listen carefully. It's unbelievable. He says they are living yeshivat keva. They are living a permanent residence in their courtyards, in their palaces. He likes to use you know, flowery terminology. So you call this conquest? There are Arabs living all over Yehuda, Shomron, Gaza. And even the nations that are idolaters, we cannot remove them. We can't get rid of the, the church of the what, or the church of that, or Al-Aqsa, or we can't. And that's why, Miyirat Umot HaOlam, because we're afraid of the nations of the world. So we're not really the Balabatim here. And if we're not the Balabatim, that's not called conquest. So it doesn't even belong to us. Ubaru, and it's clear, She'ein zeh bechlal mitzvat kibush, this is not the mitzvah of conquest. She'olav tzivdah ha-Torah lefi ha-Ramban, that the Torah commanded according to the Ramban. There's another section that I'm going to read, but I'm going to stop with this section. There's so many difficulties in it. Why is it, if we don't throw out the Arabs, that we are not the Balabatim, we don't have ownership over Yehuda, Shomron, Gaza? First of all, why should we want to throw people out of, why should we want to throw them out? And furthermore, let me ask you, what do you think would happen in the world community if the United States would decide to take all Irish Americans, bring them to Ellis Island, put them on boats, and send them back to Ireland?